Too much chocolate.
I heard chocolate's super expensive.
I know. Anyway, have a great time.
Have a great
Easter.
Weekend.
Bye.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, your weekly roundup of the latest Limestone local news. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. In today's episode, we'll be covering a first-of-its-kind study on shoulder motion from researchers at Kingston Health Sciences Center and Smith Engineering at Queen's, the Great Lakes Museum's inaugural Easter event coming up this weekend, and updates from City Council, including the long-awaited acquisition of the Lemoyne Point Farm property, the extension of Lionheart's laundry program at the now-closed Adelaide Street Shelter, and what's next for the city's addiction harm reduction services after provincial funding is cut off for the consumption and treatment site on June 13th. Without further delay, let's dive in. Kingston researchers are leading the country with a first-of-its-kind study that's reshaping how we understand shoulder movement. A team of researchers from Kingston Health Sciences Center and Smith Engineering at Queen's University have used advanced imaging technology to challenge long-held assumptions about how the shoulder functions, work that could help improve rehabilitation, injury prevention, and surgical treatment. The study, published in the Journal of Biomechanics, was conducted at the Skeletal Observation Lab at KHSC's Hotel Deer Hospital site, a joint initiative of Smith Engineering and the KHSC Research Institute. Using a specialized X-ray system, researchers were able to track bone movement in real time, offering a level of precision not previously possible in Canada. CFRC sat down with lead author and former PhD student in Smith Engineering, Aaron Lee, to learn more. What made this study unique compared to previous research in this area?
Okay, yes. So kind of the traditional method in biomechanics for measuring motion of joints is often used based on using markers that are placed on the skin. So you may be familiar with this from actually film, such as Avatar, where they put reflective markers on the skin, and then they use that to estimate how the skeleton is moving beneath it. However, you can imagine for joints like the ankle or specifically the shoulder, like in this study, our bones move quite a bit underneath the skin. So if you feel your shoulder blade on the back of your shoulder and you lift your arm, you can feel that it's moving quite a bit underneath the skin. So we lose a lot of accuracy when we try to estimate how it's moving from markers on the skin. And so this technology we have at the Skeletal Observation Lab is called biplanar X-ray. And so it uses two X-ray sources that we pulse at 60 hertz, so 60 pulses a second. And so this allows us to directly measure how the bones are moving in 3D. And so that's really what's unique about it, is it gets us highly accurate measurement of the bones. And so this was the first time we've used this technology in the shoulder in Canada. There are only two systems here in the University of Calgary. And so others in the past have absolutely studied the shoulder using this technology, but most of those studies have been focused to just looking at how the arm moves when you're raising your arm. However, for the first time, we wanted to see how the bones managed a different loading on the shoulder, so different forces. And so what was unique about this study, first of all, is the technology that we used, but then also how we studied the shoulder while it was both doing a push and a pull task to see how the joint managed that different loading configuration.
Yeah, thank you for the background on what makes this such a first. This study also challenges some long-held assumptions. What was the prevailing belief about shoulder movement before this, and what did you find?
Right, of course. So I also just want to preface in saying that, you know, this is one study of many to come. And so it's just kind of one small piece of the puzzle that's contributing to what else is out there. But like I said, most of the previous studies have only looked at specifically the shoulder blade. So that scapula bone is what we call it, how it moves when somebody is raising their arm. And so a lot of assumptions about what healthy motion of the scapula looks like has been based just at looking at that one loading configuration. And so, for example, this is used in the clinic often, where if a physiotherapist sees the scapula is moving in a way that's perceived as being unhealthy, then it might be something that they try to correct. And so, what our study did is we tried to give a broader characterization of what healthy scapula motion really looks like. And so, what was a little bit different is we found that, in previous work, it's been assumed that having more rotation of the scapula is really good for enabling good joint mechanics or good healthy function when you're raising your arm. But what we found is actually relative to when you pull your arm down, you actually have a little bit less of that rotation. And so basically, the big finding of our study was that perhaps it isn't just always more rotation is better. There might actually be a trade-off that enables good joint stability and good motion overall for the shoulder.
And this was a very collaborative study. This project brought together Kingston Health Sciences Center and Smith Engineering at Queen's. How did that partnership and cross-disciplinary collaboration kind of shape the study?
Yeah, so our lab, the Skeletal Observation Lab, is based in Hotel Duke Hospital, which is a part of the Kingston Health Sciences Center. So it's definitely been supported by a lot of wonderful people in the KHSC, especially to do with, getting set up around radiation safety, dealing with management around the space in the hospital, as well as some collaboration with surgeons. So yeah, it's been a really nice collaboration between the mechanical engineering department, as well as the great people at KHSC.
I was wondering if you could expand a bit more on, again, what that cross-disciplinary element brought to this, and why that collaboration was so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this technology is highly technical. So, like I said, we use two pulsed X-rays and then we capture the images from those X-rays and then reconfigure them for 3D motion. And so that work is an engineering challenge. It's challenging to take all this information and then get some usable data out of it. And then, of course, we have our collaborators with our the clinicians. So one clinician we did partner with is actually an international collaborator for this. So Dr. Rebecca Lawrence, she's at the University of Washington in St. Louis. And she is a physiotherapist by training and also an expert in shoulder imaging and research. So I actually went to work with her for 4 months leading into the study to learn more about how the system works and how like good strategies for using it for measuring shoulder motion. And so on top of that, also on top of all that expertise, was learning more about her clinical kind of side of things and what she sees in the clinic and important questions to ask. So,
And moving forward, how do you think these findings could impact both future research and care?
yeah, so I think future research, absolutely. So what we're doing with this study is we looked at only healthy shoulder motion. And we think that this is really important because to understand basically what's going wrong with an unhealthy shoulder, we need to understand what's going right in a healthy shoulder to try to correct back to it. So this is kind of in this knowledge to action framework, where we call it, where we're in the lab collecting knowledge, and then how is this going to lead for action in the clinic? We're kind of early on in that stage because the shoulder is so understudied that we really need to get this good basis of healthy shoulder motion first. So for one, it's going to inform future research that we can use to then look into people with shoulder pathologies. So for example, people with rotator cuff tears, which is the tearing of the tendon and the muscles that help stabilize the joint. It can help to inform future research about osteoarthritis in the shoulder and so on. But then even just the study of characterizing healthy shoulder motion, I think that, clinicians can think about this in the clinic already, and that when we're trying to correct what's considered like an unhealthy joint motion to something that's more healthy, we can use this information to understand kind of the variability in what a healthy shoulder does look like. But of course, this is really just a first step of many more to come.
While this was the last study of Lee's PhD at Smith Engineering, and she is now a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Waterloo, she says the collaborative work at the Skeletal Observation Lab, which is led by Associate Professor of Mechanical and Materials Engineering, Dr. Michael Rainbow, will continue to push boundaries.
Dr. Rainbow at the Skeletal Observation Lab, who is the director of the lab, does have a lot of exciting work on the way, looking not only at the shoulder, but then also at foot and ankle mechanics and knee mechanics, and he sort of does it all.
The study highlights the power of collaboration between hospital and university researchers in Kingston, bringing together engineers, clinicians, and imaging experts to better understand the human body and how to care for it. The Great Lakes Museum is welcoming spring with a new family-focused event, its first-ever Easter celebration. Bunnies on Boats is set to take place April 6th, inviting young visitors to explore the museum in a new way, searching for stowaway bunnies through its galleries. I sat down with Claire Notman, Visitor Experience Manager at the Great Lakes Museum, to learn more about this first-time event for the museum.
Yes, this is our very first Easter event. We wanted something that would appeal to our younger visitors. So we thought with Easter coming up and cuteness of a bunny, who can resist it? We have a lot of boat models in the museum. So we put the bunnies and the boats together and got bunnies on boats.
The team has been hard at work hiding those bunnies throughout the museum's exhibits.
We are having so much fun putting this together. What's been really fun is kind of trying to find hidden places to put bunnies so people are still able to find the bunnies. So like I mentioned, we have quite a lot of boat models. So I would suggest people that are coming to the event focus on those boat models because that might be where they find their bunnies. But these bunnies are a little bit mischievous. Quite fun to find those kind of nooks and crannies of the museum that people might not notice right away.
This event is one of several new youth-focused initiatives at the museum, including its first-ever Halloween event aboard the Keewatin last fall. A renewed focus, Notman hopes, will spark lifelong curiosity.
I really believe in lifelong learning and find that once you engage kids in a museum or a topic or a theme, you can get them interested and get them to buy in, they tend to hold on to it for their lives and come back to the museum over and over again and experience something different. So we have our Sunday fun days. So kids can come with their families, pay admission, and get an extra craft and activity to do while they're here at the museum, engaging them in a way that's not necessarily reading text panels in a museum. I also developed kind of learn for life. So stick with the museum. And when you're an adult, we can bring you more kind of, I don't want to say academic type information, but talks about from people who are experts in their field about things like, we just had one on the sturgeon. We've done a couple of talks on different shipwrecks that are here in Kingston. And so we're really kind of investing in that long-term engagement with our local community.
The event takes place Monday, April 6th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Great Lakes Museum. Tickets are $10 per person, with advance registration required to attend. Registration is on the Great Lakes Museum website and closes on Saturday, April 4th.
So if you come out this weekend, first of all, you need a ticket. This is a ticketed event and it is a registered event. That's just so we know how many treats we need to buy, because once you have found all the bunnies in the museum, you will get a treat at the end, a little treat bag. And kind of the idea behind the event is you will come in, you will get a little punch card, and you will search through the museum for your bunnies. Once you find the bunnies, you punch the card, bring it back to the front desk and get your treat bag. There will also be games and crafts available, so you can do that when you're done your hunt or before you get started.
Notman also noted Kingstonians may have an annual tradition to look forward to after this inaugural bunny hunt.
I absolutely would love for this to be a tradition. We're all already very, very excited about the turnout. We have sold almost 100 tickets, so we're almost nearing actually our capacity for this event. So if you want your tickets, you should get them now.
Once again, that was Claire Notman on the Great Lakes Museum's upcoming Easter event, Bunnies on Boats, taking place on April 6th. With unanimous approval at their last meeting, council finalized the city's purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm property for $12 million. The property has been in limbo since the passing of owner Mary Fraser in 2022. In her will, Fraser granted the city the option to purchase the land at 95% of its fair market value, with the condition that it remain as much as possible zoned for rural use. The report from city staff provided to council at their second March meeting detailed the largely behind-the-scenes process to get to this point. In May 2023, the estate trustees set the price at more than $18 million. The city disputed that figure, and a court application was made by the estate trustees seeking interpretation of parts of the will in 2024. A settlement was reached in February 2026, and the court approved the agreement to sell the property to the city for $12 million. The sale is expected to close in mid-April. Council formally approved up to $12 million in debt financing for the acquisition, with repayment to come from the Municipal Reserve Fund. Councillors around the Horseshoe expressed strong support for the purchase.
there's a lot of joy in the city, and I think they're in the council chambers of this being done, and staff did a tremendous job and deserve a lot of credit and the patience they had to have. And so I just want to echo that, and it's a reason to be to celebrate, really.
Briefly, I really think it's important that we acknowledge the Save Lemoyne Point Farm group. They did some really incredible advocacy starting back before the 2022 election. They were extremely patient. They were always respectful, both I found with council and with staff, which was really appreciated. And I really also want to acknowledge their initiative. They got out there, they held meetings, they were trying to plan some visioning. They were really trying to get behind what community wants this space to be. So while we're still a ways off from any of those kinds of decisions, thank you. Please thank your group, all the members, but particularly the leadership. You've done exceptional work here, and I hope you're really proud of what you've been able to achieve.
Members of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm group, who have long advocated for the land's protection, were also present at the council meeting, celebrating the step forward while also making clear their work is not over.
We will still be vigilant in the background, but I really want to congratulate the council. And for anyone here who might not realize, I've been involved for 35 years in defending that property, and some people in this community have been involved for longer than that. So there really are a lot of very happy people tonight. Thank you.
City staff say no immediate changes are planned, with future uses to be shaped through a community consultation process over the coming year. Local organizations and partners, including the Cataraqui Region Conservation Authority, have already expressed interest in offering programming on the site. The city says a more detailed engagement plan is in the works, with updates and opportunities for public input to be shared through a dedicated project page on the city's website. While the Adelaide Street Shelter at 38 County Street is winding down and will close on March 31st, council voted at their last meeting to allow for a short-term extension of Lionhearts Incorporated's lease for the organization's vocational laundry program to continue. The daytime employment-focused program currently employs 8 individuals and provides laundry services to shelters and care providers across the city. The program is set to move to 309 Queen Mary Road and become part of the integrated services at the new transitional housing site. However, the location is still currently under construction. The extension for the laundry program to remain in the former Frontenac Public School building aims to prevent disruption until the new location is ready. The extension allows for up to an additional 6 months, starting April 1st. Lionheart's CEO Travis Blackmore spoke before council and stressed the impact of this program and the importance of it continuing without disruption.
This is about maintaining something that already works, supporting people in a practical, dignified way, helping partner organizations operate efficiently, and doing so without adding pressure to the system. Importantly, allowing the program to remain in place creates no additional impact to the surrounding community beyond what already exists today. This is not a long-term request. It is a short-term practical step to ensure continuity while permanent location is finalized. It allows us to transition responsibly without disruption to individuals, partners, or the broader system. Our program has been, in our view, very successful in terms of seeing them acquire housing. Some of them move on to acquire their own housing, so not just through Lionheart's transitional housing, but acquire their own housing, some of which have come through the program since 2022. So it's got a proven track record. How it affects the broader community is we have a number of contracts with some local shelters to which we offer the laundry service, pickup, cleaning, delivery back. But you have 8 potential people that it could impact, coming already from their past and struggles, many of them off the street already, but again have gone forward to a brighter future, a brighter path forward, and this is a big piece to their puzzle or their life story.
While it is confirmed shelter services will not be continuing after March 31st, residents in the neighborhood surrounding the site still had concerns about Lionheart's continuing to operate from the location. A petition was presented to council from 88 residents around the Adelaide Street Shelter that asked the city not to renew or extend any further contracts with Lionhearts at the location after March 31st for any reason. One of these residents came to speak before council on the issue.
The entire Adelaide Street Shelter has been a prime example of what not to do when opening, operating, extending, and now winding down an emergency shelter. Our neighborhood, our city budget, and most importantly, the people Lionhearts was supposed to shelter and serve have endured more than enough from Lionhearts.
Councillors questioned Blackmore in regards to these community concerns.
I just want to acknowledge some concerns that we've heard from community members. I just want to ask you if you could confirm something for me. So can you please confirm that if this extension for laundry is granted, that the building is only going to be used for laundry services and it will only be for staff members that you have hired? It won't be for guests, it won't be for visitors, it will not be a spot to hang out. Can you confirm that, please?
I can confirm that 100%, just for staff, just to do the laundry contracts. That's, it's a 9 to 5, basically.
And the residents in the area have asked that you move faster. Can you?
There is, if Queen Mary Road is ready on the 1st, we'll be in there. If it's ready on June 1st, we'll be there too.
When it came time to vote on the extension, Councillor Gregory Ridge pointed to the message received from neighbours of the site.
I have had a number of very long discussions with constituents that live around the Adelaide Street Shelter. We've heard some of those concerns this evening around how the operations have gone there or how they've affected the people that are living there. And I think it's important to try and make that distinction. And the message that I've received from constituents is very clear in terms of the petition, in terms of it, which is that they just do not want that management to continue in that space, even with the laundry program.
However, Councillor Gary Osteroff pointed to the impact this program has for those employed and the city's network of services.
The value that's going to be given to those involved in the vocational training and how it benefits the vulnerable in our community. And I think we might be taking our laundry for granted at home, we really should not, because it does give a lot of dignity and self-worth and for the givers and the receivers here, and we can be part of the giving here.
With a vote of 10-3, the city will enter into a lease agreement with Lionhearts for the use of 38 County Street for vocational laundry services for not more than 6 months, commencing April 1st. Following the expiry or termination of the lease with Lionhearts, the city will move forward with the demolition of the former Frontenac Public School building. With the end of shelter services just a few days away, Councillor Gregory Ridge asked Blackmore about lessons learned from the Adelaide shelter.
My one question for you is, looking at this entire scenario with the Adelaide Street shelter in the space, is there one piece that you could point to that you would be a lesson for any organization running a shelter space or any service for the vulnerable that you've learned from this?
It's tough. I think every organization out here would say more funding. You feel like you're putting band-aids on issues and trying to triage as best as you can, but you're equipped with band-aids. I know funding across the board is an issue for any agency whatsoever. That's what I would say, more funding and changing hearts and minds to really understand the issues of everything you've heard tonight, whether it was the CTC pieces. It's hearts and minds toward actual real human beings and seeing them at one point and wanting them to be restored to some extra afforded purpose, maybe some extra dignity for their life, and realize they're a human being.
Kingston is facing a major shift in its addiction services. With the city's consumption and treatment services site set to close in the near future and no confirmed replacement on the way. Earlier this month, the province issued a 90-day notice that funding will end for the CTS sites across Ontario, including Kingston's site at the Integrated Care Hub on Montreal Street. Provincial funding is set to end June 13th. Some communities are transitioning to new provincial homelessness and addiction recovery treatment, or HEART Hubs, an abstinence-based model that includes addiction recovery, primary care, and supportive housing. Unlike previous models, they do not offer safe supply or supervised consumption. Kingston organizations that applied in the initial funding window for a HEART Hub were rejected, leaving a gap in services. And even with a HEART Hub, the city is left with a lack of life-saving services for those not ready to pursue full recovery. At Tuesday night's council meeting, two motions were brought forward aimed at responding to that gap and supporting local service providers as the closure approaches. The meeting opened with many passionate delegations from community members, including a local addiction services provider and a physician with Kingston Health Sciences Center, both urging council to find a way to keep the CTS site operating.
Without a replacement, you aren't cleaning up a neighborhood. You're moving the medical emergencies out of the controlled clinic and into the public parks. our alleyways and our business doorways. You are turning the entire city into an unmonitored injection site. These deaths won't be hidden. They will be on our sidewalks. If you remove CTS and leave only the AMHS in that building, you are pushing the remaining staff to the brink. They lose almost half their specialized team while the crisis remains at 100%.
Supervised consumption services are part of a continuum of care. They cannot exist on their own, but they also cannot be adequately replaced by other services, including heart hubs. Addiction is a complex medical condition that affects outwardly visible behavior. So it's easy for people to form opinions about how someone should act or what treatment should work, but this is a medical issue, and we should not rely solely on opinion. We should rely on systematic observation and data. And even if Kingston had a heart hub, that would not change the fact that our community members still need supervised consumption services. It'd be like trying to run a trauma system and saying, we'll fund some bandages, maybe a tourniquet, and access to a surgeon, but we'll not fund the ambulance to get people to the hospital. Certainly some injured people would still make it to the hospital, but many people would be left behind without the care they need. For some people, taking CTS away in the name of saving money will cost them their lives. If we truly value these lives, then money spent on CTS is money well spent.
The first motion, brought forward by Councillor Jeff McLaren, called on the province to reverse its decision to defund the CTS site and explore ways the city could step in. Key actions included directing staff to examine short-term funding options, potential legal avenues to delay the closure, and working with local health partners to develop a continuity plan for harm reduction services through the fall.
In planning for this, there are things that we can do, and this is the outline of a plan. An outline of a plan that is designed to save people from dying, because that's what all the experts have told us is going to happen, and I think most of us would understand that this is exactly what will happen with the closure of the CTS. It will rob people of the opportunity to change and to become better themselves, because they're not on our timeline.
However, that motion was ultimately deferred due to the last-minute addition of the motion on the day of the meeting, and after Mayor Brian Patterson told council that discussions are ongoing around the possibility of a heart hub coming to Kingston, suggesting the situation is still evolving.
So I was debating whether or not to say anything, but over the last couple of weeks, I have already been having conversations with the provincial government. They are very aware of the situation that we are in right now. And I appreciate that there are movements to try to put a plan together. I can tell you that there are already discussions happening. I have had productive and encouraging conversations along those lines. We need a heart hub. We need it. We're pushing for it. We've got a great case for it. It's already been made. So I actually would appreciate the time that this motion defer is to get these pieces in order, and then we will get a better lay of the land. It feels like we are quickly rushing into a sphere that we don't even control or understand, and we're trying to move pieces around without understanding that there's already a lot in motion. So I am asking council to just give us that time to be able to see those processes work out.
A second motion, brought forward by Councillor Gregory Ridge, focused on supporting the transition when the CTS closes. It directs staff to work with Addiction and Mental Health Services, KFLNA, and community partners to maintain services at the ICH and support local organizations in reapplying for a heart hub at the next opportunity and securing other provincial funding in the meantime.
So the two primary intentions of the motion are to A, preserve the current shelter beds that exist within the integrated care hub, and to ensure that they're protected regardless of whatever else occurs with regards to operations at the integrated care hub, financial feasibility for ongoing lease there if there are any issues, and to prioritize them for protection in our shelter system. The second part is to look for options in terms of taking the existing integrated care hub funding and putting that towards the application or beginning establishment of a heart hub to help encourage or perhaps make an application stronger. So those are the two primary pieces. Here are some things that this motion is not. This motion is not saying that I prefer heart hubs over CTS. In an ideal world, we would have both. So this motion does not preclude CTS, does not condemn it. I'm merely looking at the options that we have available in terms of policy and advocacy to the provincial government. The decisions that were made around the CTS were made by the Premier. They were made by the Minister of Health. They were not made here. We did not make any decisions about CTS here because we cannot. All we can do is work with what we have. And if there is an option to support CTS in the future, I'm happy for us to assess that. But I think that we need to, at the very least, address the service gap that does currently exist within the announcements and policy decisions that have been made by the province to try and save lives. And so that's what I'm trying to do here, and I hope that people will support this motion.
That motion passed unanimously. For now, Kingston remains in a state of uncertainty, awaiting word on whether a heart hub will be approved while preparing for the closure of a service that's operated in the city since 2018. With provincial funding set to end in June, the timeline is tight, and what comes next for addiction services in Kingston remains unclear. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. To revisit episodes and listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a Cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
That's why they call me Mr. Saturday Night. Mr. Always In, Mr. Never Missed a Good Time. I hear them say I'm jealous of that guy, but they've only seen me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. These are one of the final three episodes that we're doing with you guys. It's been quite a wild ride, but we are not slowing down. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today. A lot of stuff going on in the NHL. We're gonna tackle some new sports today, and then we've got some golf news as well. So this is gonna be quite the episode. I'm joined by Sam Schoenfeld today. Sam, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing phenomenally well. Thanks again for starting the whole show. Little does everyone know, Adam went through no small ordeal today to make this happen. He had to ensure that my voice wasn't appearing on the speaker of another room, the radio station. It was a whole fiasco, but thank you to his high IQ, we are now broadcasting to you, not live, but in conjunction and coordination, which is no small feat.
I think it's less my high IQ and more my random button mashing on the soundboard here. But yes, we did have quite the rough start to the show, but here we are now, all good to go. And actually, Sam, I think you were off the call, but as soon as I stopped the call, the microphone dropped off of the metal stand thing here, and just onto my. And I'm like, can more stuff be going wrong right now? But luckily we were able to get going and we're ready to talk about some sports. Just to do a quick, I know we talked a lot about it last week. We talked about the playoff race in the NHL a lot last week, so we're not going to focus on that as much today. But there is important to kind of show some trends happening. The Philadelphia Flyers are on a really hot run right now. They've won three in a row and are actually tied with the Red Wings and the Senators now with 86 points. They're dangerous. They're looking pretty good. I know we've talked about how crazy this East playoff race is, but I did not think a new team would be joining the fold this late into the season. But it really goes to show that if you get hot at the right time, you can really do anything. In the West, Edmonton is playing pretty good now. They've now won three in a row. They're trying to push Anaheim out of that top spot in the Pacific. So even without Draisaitl, Edmonton is doing okay. And Winnipeg is looking like a team that might be able to put some stuff together and get back into that last wild card spot. Right now, they're sitting 3 points out. So I know a couple episodes ago we were talking about how much the Canadian teams weren't really being well represented, but here's Winnipeg kind of making a push. And then if Ottawa sneaks in too, we could have 14 Canadian teams in the playoffs again. So definitely would be a good thing to see. Sam, anything from this week of hockey that caught your eye?
Well, I think you were probably getting to it, but as the great and wise minds in Toronto often do, they have fired their general manager with 8 games left in the regular season. Obviously, you and I are quite pleased to see Toronto crumble and fall. I will say this is a bit bizarre to cheer for a Canadian team to do badly, but I don't even know if Toronto counts as Canadian anymore because all their fans sprout like dandelion all over the world and all you want to do is rip them out of the ground. although one has to ask, Adam, the most important question. Who in their right mind fires a GM with 8 games left in a season? Why not let them finish it out?
And it was such a weird time for them to fire Brad Treveling because Austin Matthews had that season-ending injury a couple weeks ago against the Anaheim Ducks. Radko Gudas took him out. And this was like the rematch between that. Like Anaheim-Toronto, that was the game that was happening the day that he got fired. Like before the game was started, they announced the firing of him. And like just a weird like cycle of events to like why would you fire your coach or your manager, general manager, right before probably what's the biggest game of the season for the Leafs because they have nothing else to play for. Like I know like people are saying, oh, you know, it could be a distraction to the team. I'm like, distraction from what? Losing? Like maybe that would be a good distraction to have. But yeah, no, just a strange thing to do. I don't understand why it couldn't have waited or why they didn't do it earlier because Toronto has not been in it for quite some time. And I also don't really see the harm in letting him run out the season and then making an off-season change for a new general manager. Very odd. You got to wonder if it's like some kind of external pressure from ownership. There was a news conference today for the owner of MLSC or the CEO of MLSC, who that's the ownership group that owns the Maple Leafs. And he was asked all of these questions about the Leafs, and the guy's name is Pelly. And they were asking him about the team, and he said that he has nothing to do with this team, really. He doesn't really know too much about the functions, the daily functions of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And there were a couple times where he mispronounced top prospects' names and players on the Leafs' names that you should probably know if you're going to be the owner of the team. And now he's stepping in as kind of the guy for the rest of the season until they hire someone else. So that's Keith Pelly. And he claimed that they're not going to tank. So I don't really know what that means since they were sellers at the trade deadline and traded good players. That sounds like tanking to me. But yeah, just kind of a train wreck going on in Toronto right now. And I can't help to say, but I'm like beaming right now. I don't think I've smiled this wide in a couple weeks.
I was about to say it's raining and pouring where I am right now. And yet through the dark clouds, I see a glowing blue light that says Leafs suck. And it's never been true. I will say what I do find kind of funny, though, is that it seems like this was a premeditated firing of sorts in that Toronto got rid of so many good players. I'm only surprised that they didn't get rid of other good players. Frankly, though, I don't think that this is the GM being fired is actually pressure from management or from ownership. I actually don't.
Okay.
I think my guess is that it's from the players. Now, there's no one said anything about that. There's no rumors about it. But if I had to guess, guys like Tavares probably went up and said, this guy's got to go. Because if I was a player on the team, I'd feel a little bit betrayed. I don't think this season was supposed to be a bad year for Toronto.
No.
I feel like a lot of guys in the Maple Leafs think that Marner should have stayed. And I think Marner wanted to leave, but I don't know that the Leafs really cared to make him stay. And frankly, they just let him walk away. And that's a pretty big betrayal because the Leafs invested so much time and strategy in Marner and pushed so many guys to the side to let Marner shine. And then what? They didn't even try and protect him when the time came. Just let him walk the plank, yeah. Go to Vegas. I don't know. I just think that reflects poorly on management. And in turn, it makes the players distrust everyone around them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm sure at the end of the day, ownership decides who's there and who's not. So ultimately, it came down to them. Obviously, they wanted him gone if they fired him to some degree. The question is to what degree. I don't think, maybe this initiative came from them. It's fully possible. I just have a theory about it. Although I will say, I don't really know who would be a good fit to fix Toronto. Like, I mean, there's been a lot of great GMs in the NHL, and there's a lot of great GMs in the NHL right now. But yeah. Are there any superhumans or any gods out there who can resurrect Satan from hell?
Like, I don't.
This is not an easy task. It's the worst hockey team in the history of the world with the worst fan base and the best bad luck of anyone I've ever seen, of any team I've ever seen. It seems like an impossible task. So I wouldn't even want to be Toronto's GM if I was someone who was bloated as a name.
Yeah.
I don't know how Toronto's going to come out of this one. Maybe this Keith guy's going to stay and ruin the team even more. And by the way, on the topic of tanking, thank you for bringing that up, Adam.
Yeah.
They're 100% going to tank everything.
Oh,
I don't see why they would do anything short of tanking. It's, one, they were going to tank no matter what because it's Toronto. Toronto tends to tank even if they're not trying to tank. But, I mean, like now it's just going to be grossly intentional, which is fine, whatever, let it be. So be it. Worst things have happened before. But yeah. I do think that there should be a penalty in the NHL for intentionally tanking, which there will be.
I think they're at the point right now, like with 8 games to go, like you can't really adjust your points standings too much. Like, I guess they could fall into the top 5 and get that top 5 pick because then I don't think Boston gets that pick. So they could do that. But I mean, at the same time, like, it's pretty clear that this team is in tank mode. Like, they're not in the win mode. So. I completely agree with you there.
But anyways, let's talk about Max Domi getting some revenge for his captain, though.
Absolutely.
Not that I want to talk about Toronto too much, but I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, no. So Radko Gudas, as I was mentioning before, kind of public enemy number one in Toronto after the hit to end Austin Matthews' season. Off the first puck drop, Domi and Gudas go at it, and Domi rocked Gudas pretty hard. Like he was throwing some punches. I haven't seen that Max Domi in a long time. But I mean, I also saw that it kind of looked like Gudas was holding back a little bit. I don't know what you think, Sam, but Gudas didn't really land a punch the whole time. I don't think Gudas is a poor fighter, so I found that surprising. But I also don't think Max Domi is an amazing fighter. But I don't know. That was just my take. I thought Gudas held back a little bit. What did you see from that?
Well, I know Gudas has let himself get punched. Let's not whack around the bush.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree with you. You fully allow that to happen, but rightfully so. I think he understood that was sort of one of the unspoken laws of hockey.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't know. I think that worked out as well as possible. Max Domi got a couple good punches and Gudas probably got a little bit hurt from it. And then for the rest of the game, it wasn't really an issue. And it made Toronto feel a little bit better about themselves, probably. Probably. Well, I guess it was still a bit of an issue. But it could have been a big issue the whole game, is my point.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole game could have been about running Gudas through the boards, and it wasn't.
No.
And I think that's good in general. It's just better. And similarly, I will say this to Toronto, good for them. They saw what happens when a good player gets taken down in a dirty manner, and they didn't want to lower themselves to that level, and they didn't.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I mean, I think that fighting is one of the most respectable ways to show what the law of the ice is and what rules are to be followed and which rules aren't to be followed, and they enforce it the only proper way that I know.
Yeah, no, it was a good tilt. And honestly, the game was pretty exciting too. Like for a nothing burger of a game, I guess like Anaheim really needs points, I guess. Not too bad. They're pretty comfortable in their playoff spot, but Toronto was able to sneak out the win. I think it went to either overtime or shootout, and Anaheim lost. So I guess Toronto does get the last laugh a little bit there. But yeah, no, it was a good game. kind of nice to see, kind of some excitement. I feel like the playoff race gets really exciting for some teams, and then other teams that are down in the dumps kind of get left behind. I mean, I should know. I've watched the Montreal Canadiens the last few years be at the bottom of the barrel, and it can get boring for those kinds of fans at the end of the season when you're playing teams that are trying to vie for a playoff spot. So yeah, no, it was good to see. Speaking of other hockey news, in like other weird firing situations, the Vegas Golden Knights fired Bruce Cassidy and hired John Tortorella with 8 games left to go in the season. Now, I don't know about you, Sam, but I've never seen a coach get fired this late into a season, especially a coach on a team currently in the playoffs. Now, Vegas has like been kind of not even kind of bad. They've been bad this year. Like, they have like so many overtime losses. And they're really getting carried by those overtime losses. They have more total losses than wins. Like what's going on here? Have you seen anything like this before?
Yeah, so I don't know if you'll recall, but some 5, maybe 6 years ago, maybe longer than that now since we're 2026, must have been 8 or 9 years. I'm really aging myself there. Ottawa fired whoever was coaching at the time. Something like that wasn't 8 games before the playoffs, but something like 25 or 30. Anyways, did not work out at all.
Yeah.
I think Tortorella has a better proof of concept, but I don't think it's going to do Vegas well. It's just really weird, though. I don't really understand the strategy behind firing a coach at this stage in the game. I also don't think the Vegas Golden Knights have a team that will respond positively to Tortorella's negativity. I'm sure you've seen the memes. I'm sure everyone's seen the memes of Mitch Marner crying and wanting to leave Vegas now that Tortorella's there.
I have seen those, yeah.
but on a very real level.
Yeah.
What does Marner owe to Vegas? He can go wherever he wants.
No, exactly.
I'm sure he'll leave if he wants to leave, and Tortorella will be the guy to make him go if he's really as evil as people say. So actually, funny story, John Scott has a whole chapter in his biography about how much he hates Tortorella. That's how much players either hate or love towards. Apparently, he's just, you know, it's you either hate him or you love him. I think most people hate him, though.
Yeah.
But he gets the job done, usually.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's just really bizarre. I do think this is really bad for Vegas, though. And whoever decided to hire Tortorella clearly does not understand the dynamics of hockey in a locker room. So that's all I can really say about it. I don't know if you have any different thoughts than I do.
No, I was going to ask that. Like, what? I'm sure you probably have. I don't know if you have or not experienced a coaching change midseason on any of your teams.
A few times.
Like, what's that like? That's got to be a big change because that's your whole different coaches have different strategies when it comes to practice and stuff like that. So 8 games before the playoffs, 8 games before the most important games of the season, how big of a change will this be?
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't really speak to any specifics because I don't want to, air any bad blood that still exists because I'm sure it still does. But
fair enough.
I had one coach get fired midway through the season. And anyways, not particular situation. I think the role was sort of usurped by the assistant coaches. But anyways, it does have a bad impact, though. I mean, people did not like the first coach anyways, so it wasn't a huge problem, right? Like, nothing really changed too much.
Right.
But they certainly didn't trust the other new coaches. And also, I mean, as much as you don't, maybe, so let's say everyone on Vegas hated the old coaching. I'm going to call it a regime because with a coach comes a certain style of play, a certain style of practice, a certain set of systems. Let's suppose that everyone on Vegas really didn't like it. Mm-hmm. No matter how much they didn't like it, they bought into it to some degree. They had to implement it on the ice.
Yeah.
Tortorella is going to come in and uproot everything they've been trying to work on the whole year to implement his regime. And that's fine. That's what coaches do. But that's not going to happen overnight. And people aren't going to trust the system. They're not familiar with it. It's just not going to work out. They're just set to lose games. I've just never seen such a bad decision.
Yeah, it feels I know what you mean. It's just a surprising decision. I don't even know where that comes from, the motivation. Obviously, I understand Cassidy, maybe deserves to get fired at the end of the season. But right before the playoffs, it's just something it's unheard of. I've never heard of anything like this. So I was so surprised to see the news. I felt like the coaching changes were kind of done for the year until the off season. So definitely caught me by surprise. But yeah. I guess only time will tell again, because Vegas is right there in the middle of a playoff race right now. I personally think they will get in. I think they've got a nice roster. I think they've got a good team. Maybe that is what the management was seeing, is that they've got the players and the coach is holding them back. Maybe we'll see a more relaxed kind of Torts, because, you know, he's only got 8 games to work with before the playoffs with these guys. He doesn't really have too much time to be a doo-doo head, right? So, I mean, I guess we'll only see how well this works out for him.
I will say, if I just may add one more thing, from Torts' point of view, I have no idea why he said yes to this.
I'm pretty sure I would take a coaching gig for a team that's already in the playoffs. How much work do you have to do to do that?
Just think of what happens if everything goes to hell and they do terribly. That's his reputation tarnished. I think Torts prides himself on the fact that he turns teams around for being a jackass. There's no time to turn this team around right now. It's either you keep building on what's being built, or you run them into the ground.
But see, that's the thing, is I think that everyone kind of realizes that there's no time to turn this team around. So he's kind of going to get like a pass on this one, you know, because there's no high expectations.
It's very low reward, very high cost.
That's
if
fair,
he ruins yeah. this. If he ruins this team, his legacy will be tarnished, somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he does not care too much about his legacy, at least if people like him or not kind of level. But
no, I'm talking about a success level. In terms
yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Torts hasn't won a cup, has he?
No, I can't remember. I don't think so.
I don't know.
I'd be shocked. I think Lord Stanley's avoiding him from his grave.
I was gonna say he doesn't strike
me. For that matter, Lady Bing's avoiding him too.
Oh yeah.
Not that that's something he could ever win, but I'm sure if Lady Bing was aware of what was going on right now, she'd probably protest by throwing a tissue or two on the ice.
Oh, Tortorella won a cup in 2004 with the Tampa Bay Lightning.
When Marty carried him there, the greatest coach in the NHL.
Speaking of guys
who probably shouldn't have been good coaches, but ended up being amazing, I don't think there was any indication that Marty would be a great professional coach without any professional coaching experience.
I mean, is it crazy to say that if you are just a level-headed hockey, smart hockey player, like you can maybe have a good coaching career? Like, I feel like that's not crazy to say. Like I know he hadn't really done anything beforehand of any significance when it comes to coaching, but I mean, I've been amazed with how he can motivate and like create a good environment for this team. Like, this team genuinely looks like they love to play together.
Yeah, I mean, I think he gets it. This is the thing people forget about Marty. This guy from U Sports walked on to Calgary Flames from U Sports.
He understands
what it's like to be the worst and to be the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not something that every coach has. Most coaches either understand what it was like to be the best or to be the worst.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Do they understand both?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. He's a good balance. Anyways, moving over to some other sports today, we got to talk about the Toronto Blue Jays starting their season. They made it to the World Series last year, sadly lost in Game 7 to the Dodgers in heartbreaking fashion, but they're back. They're looking better than ever. They do have a lot of injuries on the pitching rotation to start this season, but they started off the season with a 3-game sweep of the Athletics, and now they're playing the Rockies. They dropped the first game yesterday. But yeah, the Blue Jays, they're Sam, do you have any expectations for the Jays? Do you think they'll be able to get back, or was that kind of a fluky run last year?
Well, I mean, the roster is still relatively the same. Not much has changed. I think they can do it. It's not going to be easy. I don't know. The thing is, I mean, I'm not a baseball expert by any stretch of the imagination.
No,
so part of me wonders how much of their success was luck per se mixed with hard work. I mean, look, it wasn't just luck. They worked hard and they're a talented team. But no two seasons are the same. So I think it's possible. I just don't think it'll come as easily as it did last year. I feel like they made their way there pretty efficiently last year.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, they were a good, they were one of the favorites going into the playoffs. At the beginning of the season, they definitely weren't. I think the expectations are definitely there this year. So I wouldn't be surprised if they feel a little more pressure, and that might make things a little more jittery. But again, I think it's the case with all these sports. Just try to stay healthy. Like, if you have a healthy team, like, you'll be able to put together at least your best effort. And especially with baseball, with that grueling 162 game season, it's very important that you try to stay as healthy as possible. So they're already kind of hurt in that department. But yeah, we will only be able to see such a long season. We won't be here to cover the World Series if they do eventually get back next year. But it was fun to cover the Jays during that run. Speaking of Masters, or speaking of championships, I guess we can talk about Tiger Woods, the all-time Masters champion. Had a quite the interesting weekend. It felt like I hopped into a time machine and went back to the early 2000s because he flipped his car and got arrested for a DUI. And this is not the first time that this has happened to Tiger Woods. But this was a funny story because Tiger was trying to play the Masters in a couple weeks. So he was gearing up. That's what everyone was talking about. He had done all these like TV interviews talking about it. Really seemed to have turned a new leaf and was back on the way of being a good citizen. But this kind of goes and maybe changes a lot of people's minds about that. Sam, did you see the article about Tiger and his car crash?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess it's public news, so we can talk about it. But yeah, it seems like he was pretty cooperative, but he basically just refused to pee into a cup. But he passed the breathalyzer test, so whatever it wasn't alcohol.
Yeah, they said they found two pills that are some kind of opioids. So they think that it might be like impaired driving off the opioids. So apparently, yeah,
the question too is like, opioids are painkillers fundamentally.
Yeah.
So the question too is then like, well, was this prescribed, or is he just, you know, getting stuff illegally, which is potentially what happened.
Yeah. No, it will be interesting to see what happens with this. I mean, I don't think he suffered any serious injuries in this car crash. But like, this really puts his Masters participation at risk. I mean,
well, he might just be in jail.
So. Exactly, he might just be in jail. So I mean, like, even if he is out, I don't think that the odds of him playing in this year's Masters are going to be very, very good.
No, but what one really important thing that people don't talk about enough, and this part really gets to me because it's probably the most important thing that's come out of this. If you observe the mugshot that he recently took and the one that he took from when he first got arrested
for
drinking and driving, you will notice that his forehead was much larger in the past than it is today. Yet his hairline is receding right now. It seems as though his eyes went up. So the question that it raises is this. Does playing golf for a long time shrink your forehead?
Or now, did they clone Tiger Woods?
So, yeah, this may not even be Tiger who drove. And it's a really important question. Like, all these scientists back in the late 1800s, early 1900s were measuring people's skulls and stuff for genetic reasons, trying to prove that, you know, like, you're born in this part of the world, your brain was this size, whatever, whatever. It actually means nothing. What we've learned is that golf is the greatest predictor of skull size and brain size. My theory is that Tiger Woods' brain has expanded so much that his forehead has had to shrink, so that the outward growth could be consumed by his nose and eyeballs sticking out further.
And this outward growth of his brain has caused him to drive impaired.
For the second time. I know. And people will say this is a crazy theory. And to them I say, I'm wrong. Prove me that I am wrong.
Well, if anyone wants to call CFRC and let them know the scientific evidence to break down Sam's argument, feel free. We'd love to talk about it on our show next week. But Sam, I think you might have you might be onto nothing here. But yeah, I don't know where your mind goes, Sam. You're quite the creative thinker. We are going to cover two more things before we go. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but we were talking about the World Cup a couple episodes back and Canada having to play Italy because Italy's going to walk through the World Cup qualification stage. And I'm happy to report we won't have to play Italy. It will be Bosnia and Herzegovina instead, as they knocked off the Italians in penalties. So Italy misses out on the World Cup again. Sam, is this the downfall of Italian soccer? Do they need to pack it up and just embrace baseball after their impressive World Baseball Classic performance?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what Italy's got to do. They got to get back on the penne or something, because obviously they stopped eating the pasta they were eating before. I don't really know what's happening to Italy's soccer. Ever since Balotelli, Italy has been like the Roman Empire. It's crumbled. They can't play soccer anymore. I actually don't really know how to fix the problem, though, because it's not like they have bad players.
No.
It's just really weird. It's kind of like Canada not winning a gold medal for 50 years, though. The only difference is that, you know, there was no Olympics to play in at the highest professional level. But still, I mean, Italy has no business losing to Bosnia.